Hello, everyone. These are the Gender Fluency audio recordings, and I'm Jose Domingo Cruz. In the summer of 2017, I talked with Robert Long about fluency, gender, and working as instructors in Japanese university English classes. We're joined by Charlie Bell, a university instructor and researcher based in Japan. We discuss how to turn take in conversations.
Good morning, Jose and Charlie.
Good morning.
Today, we're going to talk about the fine art of turn-taking, the do's and don'ts. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking over our transcripts, I noticed that the students' ability to take turns left a lot to be desired. Sometimes their replies were just quite minimal. Sometimes the listener would then give or wasn't able to give an adequate reply. So the ball was put back in the speaker's court, and this kind of went back and on, back and forth. They didn't seem to really understand what is a turn and how to give that turn to the other listener appropriately.
Okay.
Charlie, what do you think?
I think it's really important in these situations that you first of all, let them know what your expectation is of the conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And maybe the best way of doing that is some kind of demonstration, whether it's you and a student or maybe a pre-recorded conversation between, I don't know, two native speakers or two other students. But certainly if the students know what is expected of them, I think it's easier for them to then attempt to replicate that. In my own situation, I've tried, I try giving the students, I think I've mentioned before, I give the students a very, very bare bones conversation. And I get them to look at it and I get them to try and think what's wrong with the conversation. And it will be a bit like this. It'll be like one person asks a question, then the respondent then gives a one word answer. The next person asks a question, the next person gives an answer. And that kind of initiation response is, it's very common in textbooks, especially junior high school level textbooks. So that's probably what they think they're expected to do. But of course, in real conversation, and even in their own language, and this is what I think is important, even in their own language, that's not how conversation works. So I think some kind of awareness-raising activities where they're given a bare-bones conversation and told what, you know, they're asked what's wrong, and then to improve it. And then once they've done that, maybe at a later date, maybe the next week or the next class, they're asked to then replicate that conversation or have a similar conversation. I mean, hopefully they will take that on board and they will try and have longer turns. But I think the key is, you know, make the expectations very clear, but also give them something to work from, some kind of demonstration.
That's a good point, because I never really showed students perhaps a YouTube video of a real, this is what my expectations are of how you should be at least participating or at least half doing, trying to achieve half of that. We really haven't done enough modeling, I think.
I think that's a really important point.
Going back to a point that you made, I think, in an earlier conversation too, Charlie, was to lead up to these kind of skills so that these kids can acquire these skills. A lot of the things that we have to do, I think, have to be contrived.
Yeah, I really think so too.
And I think a lot of teachers get a little bit turned off with those contrived kind of situations. Another thing that I think teachers get turned off by is like how long it takes to actually teach something like proper turn-taking. In my experience, it takes almost three quarters of an entire academic year. I would have to be able to teach these kids for at least 30 sessions.
Wow.
I think before I can effectively get them to the point where they realize that they've always had these skills, but because of, as you're fond of pointing out, Bob, cultural limitations, plus technical limitations, plus anxiousness, that if they can just put that aside for a second, they've always had these skills. They were just never put into a situation to do it. And working up to that point in the academic year, where I just say, oh, here's your topic, or here's a topic question, consider it. Okay, everybody talk. I needed the first semester to be able to get them through all of those contrived exercises and then a review of that in the first maybe couple of weeks in the second semester. And then I say, okay, now talk. And a lot of their confidence for being able to go into the second semester to show that they can talk is the fact that they went through my test. So it takes a long time to get through this. There are no quick fixes for it, and it's hard to do. And I think a lot of a lot of us instructors don't realize the time frame that's necessary, and that's why where we tend to kind of give up a bit.
Well, I mean, we have to sort of set up a contrived situation. We have to also model it. I think the other thing we also have to do is give them a real purpose before they engage in a conversation about what kind of information do they want to get out of it. Sometimes students have no purpose when they start talking, or they have a minimal purpose, or they're easily satisfied with the information that they get. And so we have to kind of get them to really have higher expectations when they get into a conversation, and then learn how to give the appropriate hints and signals about getting the listener to contribute, signposting. Sometimes I've seen a lot of conversations where people have a habit of going into wild tangents or leading the conversation leads nowhere.
Yeah, like me.
which is kind of quite dissatisfying. But getting students to kind of have this goal in mind, and this is what they want to achieve with this conversation, and having higher expectations.
To be fair, though, I would try first to make sure that they have basic conversation skills
step by step.
Right, and with a lot of these kids, they already have the technical knowledge. They in first language, and the technical knowledge for or subjects, verbs, and objects in their second language. But speaking is a completely separate skill. And if they don't have the actual skill set to be able to do this stuff, and if you as an instructor are not providing it to them, and then suddenly at the end saying, oh, you guys are so boring when you talk, you don't talk about anything interesting, and you don't know how to do this and that, I think that's kind of unfair to the student. So it I think understanding how long it takes to get this out of any individual, I think is a really important thing.
Well, the other important thing we have to think about is how to get students to solicit an opinion, how to give opinions that are actually engaging. As you know, most Japanese are afraid to give an opinion. A long time ago, I had my second year students, I would actually have a sheet on different topics, family, friends, whatever. And I had them write their opinion. And I found that they had a hard time giving an opinion. They would give information. I have four people in my family.
Yep.
But that's not an opinion. That's information. My family is better than your family is an opinion. Something like that. So getting them to just understand what an opinion is, how to write an interesting opinion, and then how to kind of segue that opinion into a conversation. Charlie, what do you think about that?
I mean, I like doing a lot of task-based learning stuff in my classroom. So one of the things they do have to do is kind of negotiate with one another to get to the sort of communicative goal. But I have a similar problem. I mean, for example, if I wanted them to, for example, tell me an interesting holiday destination for each of the four seasons, as opposed to making suggestions and rejecting suggestions and sort of arguing with one another, what they'll do is one person will make a suggestion and everyone will agree with it. And there'll be no negotiation. It'll be one person says the answer. Okay, next person says the next answer. Next person says the next answer. But something else I've been trying to do in my sort of more intermediate level classes is before we have like an opinion based discussion, give them like a list of maybe sort of 5 to 10 different statements. Get them to agree or disagree with them, and then in a pair or in a group, then look at each other's answers, and if they disagree, they have to explain why. Once they've, you know, either given it a tick or a cross, that's their opinion. Then they can't go back on that. So I found that's a really good way of making sure somebody does actually go through with what they believe, as opposed to just being like, "Oh, he thinks that. Me too."
Right.
So if you've written down, "I think this," or you don't have to write it yourself, but if you just agree with a point that's been written down. If you just give it a circle or a tick, I think that's a really good way of, you know, making sure somebody sticks to their opinion.
That's good.
That's worked in my classroom.
I think one of the other things, too, that I've taken up in my classrooms, but dating back at least about 10 or 12 years ago, was understanding the cultural limitations that these kids have in easily, honestly professing opinions in their own classroom among their peers. They don't want to express their opinions. It's not necessarily just a bad thing. That's just the way it is in Japan.
Right.
That can create disruptions to their ideas of harmony. And when you then have a classroom with these kids and they know how to relate to each other in Japanese and they're not familiar with English as their second language, only as a foreign language, and then you suddenly ask them, oh, well, tell each other your opinions. Come on, you can do it. Mm-hmm. They're still working within the paradigm of their Japanese lives. And what I use as a way to counter that is I tell them you have to provide an opinion, but not necessarily your own. It just has to be an opinion, something strongly held, something that has reasons. And I make it to the point where they can't tell whether this person is actually holding that opinion honestly and personally or not. But the only important thing is whether or not they're actually able to profess the opinion. So you tell them, here's the opinion that this row, because I've always got them, you know, in pair work in separate rows. This row says that the best musical group in Japan is this girl group. And then I've got another topic. Okay, no, this row of people, your favorite one is this boy group. And they just go at each other, whether they like it or not, because in about 40 or 60 seconds, depending, they'll switch and the ones who are taking the boy group before have to take the girl group. So it doesn't really matter what your real opinion is. You might actually believe it, and you might actually want to honestly say it, but that's up to you to say it to the other person. But you have to become devil's advocate at some point.
Right.
And then we come up with things like sumo versus baseball. Two, well, at the 10 years ago, those are two very well-loved Japanese sports, but young people hate sumo now.
Right.
So I go with soccer and baseball. Or we go with, I don't know, Japanese food versus American food. And they can come up with good points for both. The really brave ones will start to actually say, no, that's not as good as my opinion. But you get them to the point where you're just able to provide reasons for it. Then you get them to go at each other's throats. And you tell them, no, now you're fighting with each other. And that builds on a prior exercise that I do where I tell them that, no, whatever the other person says, you just disagree with it.
Well, the other issue with opinions also is facilitating that and to kind of rolling with the conversation. And, I mean, you can say, moreover, I feel like I mention facilitation, though, is much more difficult than it sounds. Actually contributing stories, giving examples. Have you had much problems with getting students to facilitate the conversations and adding in examples and stories? Sometimes these topics go too quickly.
I don't ask that of my students because I don't have enough time, I think, with my teaching method to be able to get to the point where I can comfortably feel that they're actually doing what they need to do to get it so that it's internalized. There's a point where you're actually just teaching facts or you're just teaching skills, and yes, they're going to get to the skill, but have they internalized it? Have they realized that this is something that's important for them to do? Or they're just doing it to get, they're told to do it, they're just getting the grade. And if I'm lucky, I have one student from first year, I complete them through first year, and then I have them again in second year. And then I have, what is that? That's 60 sessions with that kid. But most of the time, I have a kid in first year and rarely get them again in second year. I often have situations where I have second year students who never took my first year class. So I have to do a lot of this, what I think is basic fluency with those kids again, while at the same time trying to treat them as second year students. So in my opinion, my way of thinking, getting to the point where they're telling stories, where they're, you know, rebutting or professing, that's hard to do even with 60 sessions, much less 30, much less the situations that I have. I think it's really, I wouldn't have the time to be able to do something like that. I don't know. Do you have any success with that, Charlie?
So I think on like very basic, like back channeling devices. I mean, in Japanese, like back channeling is a huge thing. Like a so. It really helps the speaker know that they're being listened to. And we were discussing earlier actually that
that's easily taught.
We have a we find it almost a bit strange in English when as English native speakers for to be kind of
back
to have these to be back channeled, yeah. But at the same time, we also do it like right, yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think very basic back channeling like tools like that are really useful to teach.
Sure.
And you can get the students to think about what it's like in their own language, get them to say, you know, how do people show they're listening in Japanese or in whatever other language? And they were like, well, right, now, you know, look at this script or listen to this conversation. How are the speakers showing that they're listening? And then they can like either pick that up themselves.
Mm. I'm going to give you an interesting observation I have on that back channeling. When I first started teaching what's called back channeling, and in Japanese the word is aizuchi, I started teaching it maybe about 10, maybe 15 years ago, and with basically the same level of kids that I have now. And when I said, this is what we do in English, and actually you do the same thing in Japanese, and I said, well, here's a really basic set of back channel words. Mm. Right. That's true. Oh, okay. Or the basic one, just say yes. Mm. They would see my demonstration of how to do it, and they would go, oh, I'll pick that up, and they start doing it. Now, I'm pretty sure I have the same kind of skill level students now, but they're, even though I know that they do it in Japanese to a certain degree, I find that they're much less comfortable doing it than those kids that I was teaching about 15 years ago. And I think that speaks more to the cultural changes that are occurring in Japan in their first language, as opposed to what it is that we can or cannot teach in Japanese. Kids are just less conversive. Kids are just less prone to want to communicate. I think anyone who keeps up with Japanese culture knows that it's a noted phenomenon that these kids would rather message each other on their texting systems as opposed to calling each other on the phone.
Right. I'm the same though. I don't call anyone ever.
And well, to me, I think that speaks of a lot of things that are happening, not just in Japanese culture, but across the world.
Well, there's a lot of fine arts that are in a conversation. And, you know, one of them, you know, just changing the topic. Another is being able to argue forcefully but politely. I've noticed in a lot of people have a hard time doing that in their L2. Easy to do in the L1, but L2, it seems to kind of becomes harder. Well, anyway, I think it's been an interesting conversation. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Jalen.